everyone. I'm Franklin Jacoby, and welcome to the ICE at Dartmouth podcast. Today I'm speaking with Professor Marcelo Gleiser, Director of the Institute for Cross-Disciplinary Engagement at Dartmouth. Talking with him is really the best way to understand the Institute, why it was started, and what sort of work happens there. In later episodes, we'll talk to past fellows of the Institute about their work. In addition to Director of ICE at Dartmouth, Marcelo is a theoretical physicist at Dartmouth College, where he holds the Appleton Professorship of Natural Philosophy and is Professor of Physics and Astronomy. Marcelo works on topics including cosmology, high-energy physics, and astrobiology. Marcelo has published numerous essays, hundreds of academic articles, and a number of books. He received the 2019 Templeton Prize. And here is our conversation. Hello, and thank you, Marcelo, so much for taking the time to talk with me. So you're the director at the Institute for Cross-Disciplinary Engagement, and that the Institute is principally concerned with trying to foster a kind of cross-disciplinary community. Is that right?
Yes. So the initiative came maybe 5-6 years ago when I was approached by some officers of the John Templeton Foundation, and they were interested in expanding their public engagement in some way and had essentially asked me for some ideas. And I said, well, give me a couple of months, let me think about this and see what I can come up with. And what I came up with was this idea of creating an institute at Dartmouth funded by the John Templeton Foundation primarily, where I would create many different kinds of activities that would promote the engagement between the sciences and the humanities in general. And so that was the kind of the impetus. And the notion being that, you know, since C.P. Snow's famous essay in the late 50s, you know, about his ready lectures in Cambridge, it is pretty clear that the worlds of the sciences and the humanities, really since the Enlightenment, have been kind of moving away from one another. And that is a loss for both the sciences and the humanities. And to the point where people don't even perceive it as a loss anymore, because there is such deep disconnect that to say a scientist say, why do I need to listen to philosophers or historians? And vice versa, you know? And so that is a shame in many, many ways because of what I believe is the need for us to look at what I call the complementarity of knowledge, in which essentially when you think about very fundamental questions that humanity faces now and has faced in the past and will certainly be facing in the future, we really need to look at different ways of knowing, not just a strictly scientific or humanistic perspective. And that's the idea that kind of prompted the need for this institute.
How did you come to, I mean, your background is a theoretical physicist. How did you come to have this recognition that the humanities and the sciences really needed to have more of a dialogue? Is it from looking at that history of how they started closer together and have been moving apart?
Yeah, it was certainly not from my colleagues, I can tell you that, you know, because, you know, being within the tribe of science, so to speak, you know, and tribalism is something we should talk about at some point, is you really do not see any connectivity whatsoever with mostly philosophy, really, which is the closest thing that we can think of from the humanities. But because of the nature of my research, which is in cosmology and high energy particle physics, you know, it is very hard, at least for me, and that may have something to do with my upbringing. You know, I grew up in a family that had a very strong continental tradition of literature and philosophy. You know, I grew up surrounded by books and people that actually read them, you know, which, you know, from very, let's say, highbrow literature and from many different kinds of philosophers. And I think that kind of prompted me to think of knowledge not just as a one-dimensional enterprise, but actually as something that needs the environment that comes from the many different ways in which you can ask the same question, you know. So when you, let me give you an example that is pertinent to my research, you know, when you ask about the origin of the universe, which is obviously a very scientific question nowadays, because cosmology, you know, the part of physics that deals with the history of the universe is very much concerned with the beginning of that history, which is the early universe. So how did the universe come to be? Or as Leibniz had asked a long time ago, why is there something rather than nothing? You know, and so that was a question that was from Leibniz, but there was also a question that way before science existed, many religions across the world do have some narrative of creation. And so perhaps because of my readings and my interest in this complementarity of knowledge, I realized that many of these questions that science is asking now are not just pertinent to science, but they're really part of human knowledge as a whole. And people have been asking a lot of these questions for a very long time. And so to me, to just focus on the technical aspects of the research, you know, can I write a little model of the early universe so I can formulate, you know, the origin of the universe as some quantum fluctuation of space-time and say that I solved the problem, was deeply unsatisfactory. Yet, many of our famous scientists were making these pronouncements that, yeah, we have solved the origin of the universe. And that to me was just fundamentally wrong. And so it made me very uncomfortable. So when I joined Dartmouth, in the early 90s, I developed a course with a historian of science on what we, you know, people, the students call it physics for poets, but really is a history of physics with a lot of philosophy thrown in. And it became clear to me how essential it is to ask these questions with an understanding that we are not the first people to be thinking about them. So when you talk about the origin of life, or when you talk about the origin of matter, or when you talk about the origin of the universe or the origin of mind, people have been dealing with this sort of questioning for a very, very long time, even though obviously using very different methodologies from the scientific one. So that was my own personal kind of feel to this. And I think I realized that I wasn't alone. You know, many other scientists, many other theoretical physicists, they do have a, let's call it, a philosophical bend, not so much here in the United States, but certainly in Europe, you know. So, and that to me is wonderful, because it shows that there is an opening, you know, an intellectual opening to kind of grow together as a community by exchanging important knowledge and information, as opposed to kind of close the walls, you know, and say, I cannot learn anything from philosophy, and philosophy cannot learn anything from science, which I think is truly a deep mistake.
You mentioned tribalism, and I'm glad you did. It strikes me that this is what the Institute is trying to do, is actually quite a challenging task, given how tribal, if you like, different disciplines have become. We've come so far with physics and biology and with history there, and there's so much mastery that a student of one of these disciplines has to undertake, that it's hard to breach the boundary to come to understand physics if you're not a physicist, or understand philosophy if you're not a philosopher. How has that challenge been, or how do you see that challenge?
So that's a very good question. And you can think of it in different dimensions. You can think of it from a professional perspective as a scientist, or as a philosopher, or as a historian, or as a social scientist. How do you engage with people from different disciplines, right? And the biggest challenge there is really a challenge of jargon. You know, we have promoted, one of the things that we do at the Institute is we promote these workshops where we bring together, first of all, we come up with a big topic, right? And then we bring together people from different areas. And you can hear, so for example, we had one that we called The Blind Spot, which is a book that I'm writing with Adam Frank, and who is an astrophysicist, and with a philosopher of mine called Evan Thompson. And so we brought different philosophers from the US and from Europe, and quantum physicists and cosmologists and historians of science, and just to talk about the notion of incompleteness of knowledge. You know, how much can we know of the world, and can we go all the way? You know, is the world out there for us to figure out completely? Is it a mind game in a sense, like a Plato thing that, you know, it's all a big kind of that's a blueprint and it's completely rational and understandable by the human mind, or are there fundamental limits to what we can understand? So, and it was clear that some of us made an effort to speak across disciplines while others did not, because they just can't. So there is that difficulty. And the same thing happens in a field, even within the sciences, for example, astrobiology, right, which is the study of life on Earth and elsewhere in the universe, where you have geochemists and theoretical physicists and information theorists and biologists and biochemists and you name it, and atmospheric scientists. And boy, you go to a conference, you know, it's really wild, because it is very hard to understand one another, because people are not trained to pay attention to the fact that if you want to talk across disciplines, you really have to focus your language, you know, know thy audience, let's put it that way, instead of know thyself like Socrates, and know thy audience, you know, and really kind of focus and understand that the people listening to you will not have the same set of tools that you do. And that is hard. And that's the same problem with, you know, public understanding of science in general, even public understanding of philosophy. You know, how do you cut down the technicalities to actually speak to one another in ways that we could? So that is an issue. And a lot of the animosity, I think, that appears between the sciences and humanities is really because of the inadequacy of the language that people are using. You know, it's not so much that they're not interested in the same topics, and many times they are, but is that just they just don't know how to talk to one another. So that is a certain challenge.
Yeah. How do you manage that challenge? I mean, if you're trying to approach some other discipline that you think might be relevant, but they're just using all these bizarre terms and difficult language, and how do you breach that divide, bridge that gap?
So let's see. So we have three different main activities at the Institute for cross-disciplinary engagement. One of them we already talked about, the workshops. And so what I do with the workshops is I prime every speaker very carefully about precisely this issue. Look, we're here to learn from one another. And if you're really interested in learning from one another, then you really need to speak in ways that the other person will understand you. And it's an effort, it's not easy, but needs to be done. And so we have a lot of time for, not just for the presentations, but also for the after presentation discussions, where I kind of try to force these barriers to break down. And then the other activity that we have is what we call the public dialogues. And these are the really in your face, across the disciplines, you know, kind of effort, which is I invite a scientist and I invite a humanist for a conversation in front of a live audience on big questions. So we had many, many amazing people participate in that. So we had Antonio Damasio talking to David Chalmers on the nature of consciousness and the hard problem. So you have a hardcore neuroscientist, a hardcore philosopher of mind, and I mediate the conversation. And in the case of in front of hundreds of people, there was one that had almost 2,000 people. There was Sean Carroll, the physicist, and Alan Wallace, the Buddhist scholar, and really I mean, he trained with the Dalai Lama for 17 years. So he's the real thing. And that was in San Francisco. And so you have a physicist and a Buddhist, and the topic was the nature of reality, right? And how did they come to talk about these things? And it was a great success, because what I try to do is I'm very careful about picking the right people. So I already know these speakers, you know, from before, and I know that they are able to do this, you know, that they can actually talk to one another and to a general audience in ways that people can understand. So when I had like Alan Lightman, the physicist and writer and novelist, and Rebecca Goldstein, the philosopher and novelist, talking about the nature of faith, I knew it was going to work out, because I already knew they are able to do this. So the selection of who you bring in to speak to a live audience is, I think, essential. Because if you bring people that cannot talk to one another and to the general public about their topics, you know, it's going to be a failure. Nobody's going to learn anything from the conversation.
It sounds too like it's essential to having someone with your skills who's able to select the right people, but also prime them in the right way, and also prepare them and ask the right, as you're moderating, ask the right questions and bring them, I mean, together. It really seems to be a personal individual project as much as an institutional endeavor.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, okay, so one of the biggest things that we've learned about this is if you bring journalists who are very thoughtful, and they are really good at this. So we had, and scientists, journalists as well, like we had one with Siddhartha Mukherjee, who wrote Cancer, you know, the Prince of Maladies, and he wrote a book about genetics. So he's a real medical doctor, but he writes for The New Yorker. And we brought Elizabeth Colbert, who also writes for The New Yorker, who about extinctions and environmental issues, and to talk about endings, you know, the end of human life in the case of Sid, you know, Mukherjee, and Elizabeth Colbert talking about the end of life on Earth. So the notion of extinction. And so that is another way of doing it that works very well. So you bring very, very good, well-versed writers for the general public about difficult topics. So because you know they're going to be able to do that. But yes, this is a project of mine that goes really beyond the idea of this institute, which is really at the very heart, I think, of liberal arts education. You know, and that is the second part of this conversation. So first is, okay, we want to have the scientists and the philosophers talking to one another, and how do you go beyond the two cultures? And, you know, the public dialogues is an example, the workshops is an example, the fellows, of whom you are part of, is an example, you know, people that will give general, like, so you're also not just bringing in people, but forcing them to talk to an open audience so that they have to adapt their language in ways that different people can understand. And then, of course, being the culture of a liberal arts school, such as Dartmouth, has also been very influential, because I know from experience, from teaching for almost 30 years here, that the students absolutely love this kind of conversation. They love the exploration of scientific questions. They have a philosophical impact, or they have a religious impact, you know, and or historical impact, and they want to be part of this. And they, I have hundreds and hundreds of emails of gratitude from students saying that this is precisely why I joined a liberal arts school, you know, because I really want to be able to talk not just about the Big Bang, but about the religious implications of the Big Bang and the philosophical implications of a theory that tries to explain everything and is doomed to fail. You know, why is it doomed to fail? You know, so that's my own personal view of that kind of power of scientific explanation. But the point being that this is really what liberal arts education is about, is exposing the students to these different ways of framing answers to the same question, you know, like for example, what is life? Wow, you can think about what is life in so many different ways, you know, including the scientific one, but that's not the only one. And what are the many dimensions of this question? And I think that's a very enriching experience to the students. And I have to be honest, for me too, because I learned so much from the conversations with the students and obviously with my colleagues from different disciplines.
Do you think that, and do you see that desire, that hunger for interdisciplinary, multiple approaches to the same question? Do you see that more? Do you feel in students? Is that where that passion really rests? Is that where the driving force is coming from?
I think that definitely the students have that, and especially when you frame it the right way. But not just the general public too. I mean, one of the things that we do with the public dialogues is that we give them surveys afterwards, asking a few questions about how they felt about the conversation, about the topic, and also about one of the questions that always for the last 4 years, always ranked at the highest rating of enthusiastic response is, do you think the conversation between the sciences and the humanities should continue? And it's like a 98% yes kind of thing. You know, it's like overwhelmingly support. So why is that? Well, because I think people identify the fact that we are now living in a time where some of the most important questions that we have to deal with are multidimensional questions. So climate change. So when you talk about climate change, there is a very scientific way of thinking about climate change, you know, and you can talk about all the models of couplings of currents and atmospheric circulation and how that's going to spread inwards and why the fires in California related to this and the hurricane season, etc. So there is a scientific modeling perspective. But then there is this political dimension to it. There is an economic dimension to it. There is a social dimension to it, because different people react to this in different ways, and how are they being impacted in different ways in different parts of the world, really. People are suffering the effects of global warming in very different ways. And so you cannot talk about global warming just by looking at, oh, it's a political problem. Oh, it's a financial problem. Oh, it's a scientific problem. It's all of the above. And so you need this openness of mind and openness of methodology, you know, like to be able to bring together different ways of thinking about this problem so that you have a better understanding of all its multidimensional aspects, so that you can become a better leader in the future and a better citizen. So that's just one example. Here's another one, artificial intelligence and automation of the workplace, right? So AI is a big deal, right? And you're talking about the scientific aspects of AI, you know, strong AI, meaning will machines dominate the world and destroy humanity, like Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and a bunch of other people say they would. You know, Elon Musk called it summoning the devil, right? And so there is that thing, and there is transhumanism, which is people that believe that, yes, they will become pure information and connect with AIs and stuff. But then there is, you know, the weaker kind of AI, which is about using computers in the workplace to automate a series of functions and search engines and data mining that will make a lot of jobs that we now have obsolete. And so how do you deal with that in the future? I mean, you're creating new jobs for sure, but is education adapting itself to this new job need? I mean, are people in these universities and colleges and technical schools being trained to deal with a completely different kind of marketplace, you know, due to this new technology? And so again, you know, there is the scientific, there is clearly the philosophical aspect of artificial intelligence, but then there's a very practical and also ethical dimension to this problem. And so if you're going to train you know, the new citizens, right? The citizens of the future, the students, the leaders, you know, the people that are going to make a difference in the world in 5, 10, 20 years, they need to be exposed to all of that. So that is where the Institute connects with the whole mission of liberal arts education.
You mentioned earlier that journalists, and it strikes me that something very interesting about the Institute is that it doesn't mediate between researchers and the public. It brings people who are doing this cutting edge work, biologists, physicists, philosophers, in direct contact with the public. What do you think, I mean, what are the challenges with that? And what do you think are the benefits of not having sort of journalistic mediation between the two?
Well, I think people want to sometimes hear from the source. And so here's an example. There was one public dialogue where we partnered with the Chicago Ideas Festival, and we brought Jill Tarter, who is one of the founding members of the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Initiative, you know, the SETI program that tries to listen to aliens, right? Radio emissions from extraterrestrial intelligences. People watch the movie Contact. Well, Jodie Foster's character is inspired on Jill Tarter, actually. And Patricia Churchland, who is a philosopher of mind, pretty hardcore, very scientifically minded philosopher of mind, and from University of California, San Diego. And they talked about the nature of intelligence, human, machine, extraterrestrial. And we had in the audience about 50 high school students that came specially to listen to this, right? And they were just fascinated. Here were these two elderly stateswomen of science and philosophy, you know, talking about this phenomenal cutting-edge science on really amazing topics, like artificial intelligence and aliens. You can't beat it, right? Especially for kids. And they just ate it up. They just loved the opportunity to listen directly from these superstar thinkers, you know, about these topics, which are so fascinating. So it's really the promoting these conversations, and when we invite fellows, and which is a more local event in the sense that is they will give public lectures to our local community. They love this because they are being exposed directly to the people that are the creators. You know, they are the ones that are making a difference in the world of ideas and the world of science and the world of the humanities. And you can listen to them, and they absolutely love it. So, for example, just give you an example of a public dialogue that we actually had at Dartmouth was on plant intelligence. So we had Richard Powers, who won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction with his spectacular book, The Overstory. And we had an Australian scientist slash mystic, Monica Galliano, to talk about her scientific experiments and mystical experiments with plants. And it was a completely packed. We had to have two overflow rooms because people are just fascinated with the idea of different kinds of intelligence that you could not be thinking about 20, 30 years ago. This is all new, pretty much, right? I mean, to actually think. And so this is cutting edge science. This is spectacularly beautiful literature. I'm a big fan of Richard Powers and his writing. Very scientific, but also very lyrical, you know, and I think he really hit the jackpot with this book. And it was very interesting because you could see in the audience, Monica is more of a, let's put it this way, controversial character, because she combines this conflicting approaches, you know, of scientific methodology and mystic intuition, let's put it that way. And you could see how some of the people more in the mystic side of the audience loved what she was saying, and some of the people in the more scientific side of the audience were just not very excited about this at all. You know, they liked the conversation, they liked certainly the fiction, but they did not think that this was the way to talk about the science of plant intelligence. You know, so, and this is important because sometimes conflict is good. You know, it's when you have this sort of conflict that you grow intellectually, you know, and you identify what are the points of soreness, so to speak, within each tribe, right? And what we are seeing right now, and this is another reason why I thought of this institute initially, was we have so many attacks on science right now, and so many attacks on science that come from ignorance of what science is, right? So I thought that if we brought or how science operates, that if we brought scientists to talk about their work directly to the audiences, but then remember that we have an online presence as well. So everything that we do, including this podcast, becomes available in principle for a very long time for those who want to listen to or watch it. So we're really reaching the world, right? That's the power of media these days. And so to bring this conversation across boundaries, across countries, across intellectual tribes, so that maybe slowly, you know, you have a more productive garden here where different people will come together and understand that they actually can learn from one another, as opposed to becoming defensive and protective of their own sort of ways of knowing as being the only viable ways of thinking about something.
How do, I mean, you mentioned earlier about the importance of putting a lot of effort into this. This isn't an easy thing to try to bridge these gaps between tribes, particularly humanities and the sciences. And you do get these sore points. What do you, how do you feel those, I don't know, sore points or controversies affect your work as the director of the Institute for Cross-Disciplinary Engagement?
Yeah, so to be honest with you, over all our experiments so far, everything has been incredibly positive and well-received, with the exception of the plant intelligence. What I got on that one, I mean, there was a subgroup of scientists from Europe that got very offended that I invited Monica as opposed to a more established and party line plant ecologist or plant physiologist to be the scientist in on stage, you know, and I think that is part of the problem, right? And it shows exactly where the as I mentioned before, the sore spots are, you know, that there is people feel threatened by anyone that tries to bring in elements which are not already part of the very well understood and methodology, you know, this is how you do science, period, right? And so anyone that goes beyond that or tries to force that is going to be pushed away, you know, at least going to not be completely absorbed, let's put it that way. And it's an interesting phenomenon because in theoretical physics, which used to be a place where this happened. So when I started my career, so we're talking 30, 35 years ago, you know, physics was also pretty conservative. And even the people that devoted some of their times to public understanding of science were criticized, like Carl Sagan. He never became a member of the National Academy of Sciences. And even though he has done tremendous work as an astronomer and planetary scientist, and one of the reasons people say is because of his effort in publicizing science, you know, and in French, you know, it's called vulgarizing some vulgarisation scientifique, which I think is a horrible name. But it speaks to the fact. So even when I wrote my first book, which was in 1996, I remember people saying that, well, you cannot possibly explain quantum mechanics without using the formulas. How can you do that? And then I said, there is a difference between forming training a scientist on how to do quantum mechanics, how to solve the problems, how to become a theoretical or practical or applied scientist using quantum mechanics, and informing the people about quantum mechanics. You know, it's the same thing. I remember I made this analogy between you can appreciate a Mahler symphony and really, you know, resonate with the music and the beauty of it and the power of it and learn from it without learning how to write how to read or write a score, a musical score, or learning how to play an instrument. So that's the same idea. You can bring the core concepts of scientific knowledge to the general public without being a scientist, or without, you know, having an audience of scientists listening to you, because my belief is that science is an essential and fundamental, really, part of culture, and as such, it should be celebrated and it should be discussed by as large a number of people as possible, you know. And so what has happened in the last 20 years or so is a complete turnaround, where the scientific community has at least the physics, mostly physics, really, some chemists, but mostly physics and astronomers have completely understood this. And now there's a huge, or growing anyways, community of people that are really devoted to this public understanding of science as a necessary part of the scientific enterprise. You know, you have to justify why your work is important to the general public, because at the end of the day, a lot of the money that we get to do our research comes from, you know, the public, from the taxes people pay. And so why should you be paying to build a giant telescope or a giant particle accelerator? What is humanity going to gain from this? Well, you have to explain to the people, you know, otherwise they will say no, right? That's not the point. And there have been some dark episodes in the recent history of science funding where this was an issue. You know, like with the superconducting super collider that was going to be built in Texas, and it was all approved to go. And after $2 billion were spent and a big tunnel was dug, at least part of the tunnel was dug in Texas, you know, the Congress pulled the plug on the whole project and it was suspended. And that was also because there was no sufficient support within the physics community for a project that big in the United States, you know, which forced physics and this kind of project to become internationalized. So now it's much more a global initiative than United States versus Europe or versus Japan or versus China. Of course, that exists still, but most of the big, big scientific projects, what Freeman Dyson used to call Napoleonic science. I love that. They're really kind of international efforts, which is precisely how it should be. You know, it's not a country versus the other. It's really us working together for the benefit of humanity as a whole.
And I suppose, too, that that sort of outreach work is also crucially important for helping to prevent things like science from becoming overly political or agenda-driven, having them be in the service of the public and not be serving those sort of other purposes.
That's exactly right. So we hope that one of the byproducts, two of the byproducts of this institute are, one, that people learn more about science, and by doing that, they will understand why the Earth is not flat and why you should take vaccines and why global warming is happening and it is anthropogenic, you know, caused by us mostly. So that there is an understanding of how science actually works. And because of that, it regains the respect that has been lost, a lot of it due to tremendous propaganda, you know, which is politically based and unfortunate. And the other one is really inspiring the young generation to become scientists, you know, especially women and minorities, you know. So that is a big push that we have as well, you know, that the more you talk about science in ways that people can understand, the more people can understand it, and the more people will choose it as a way of living. And that's the idea, you know, that, and our public really varies. Our audience has a big age range, and that is exactly how it should be. You know, we are hopefully inspiring young and old people alike to think scientifically, but in a way informed by the humanities about the world, that we cannot just look at the sciences and think that science alone will solve all our problems, because it will not, right? So you can develop a science, since we are taping this during a pandemic, you know, we could develop a vaccine for COVID-19, but if you don't have a proper socioeconomic plan to distribute that vaccine, not just in one country, but across the planet, then huge problems will appear, you know, because of the unfairness and injustice of some sectors of the population having access to a vaccine and others not having access to that vaccine. So yes, it is a scientific problem, but it is also a political problem and is a socioeconomic problem. And it has a lot to do with social justice and fairness, not looking just within a country, but to the planet as a whole at this point.
And so it's a moral problem too. How do you do what's right and fair with all of this work that's happening?
Yeah. So, you know, you cannot, and morality is a very interesting question to discuss within the pharmaceutical industry, which could be another podcast, you know, and, you know, if you have the cure for something, how much are you going to charge for that cure, and how much is fair to charge for that cure, and how many people are you excluding from having a good life, you know, a healthy life because of your, you know, the greed of your company. But that's a different kind of conversation. But the point is that the more people understand the science, the more they're going to be willing to take the vaccine when it's available, so that we all benefit as a group, you know. So I think one of the things that we're learning all through the Institute and also through the pandemic is that we really have to make a push beyond the tribalism that has kind of defined our history since, you know, the very, 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 very early ages of our existence to nowadays. And it's time for us to move beyond these tribal divides. And this goes from knowledge to moral stances. And it's not easy, but it needs to be done if we are to bet in the future of humanity as a good one as opposed to a bad one.
We should probably think about wrapping up soon, but maybe I'll just ask, where do you think this, I mean, after spending so much time with the Institute and working with those people, where do you think this will take you next, or take the work next?
Yeah, so one of the things that that was very nice to see is that other schools started doing very similar things, you know, adapted to their own environments, of course, but in the last few years. And I don't know to what extent it was premeditated or not. If they were inspired by what we're doing, that's wonderful. And if they were not, then it shows that there is a zeitgeist that is kind of growing, right? I mean, Yale has a center for the sciences and the humanities that promotes very similar events to ours. Columbia started this Institute for Ideas and Imagination in Paris, which is also trying to do something similar. Harvard has something about arts and STEM disciplines for the benefit for social justice, which also is bringing together scientists and humanists to kind of create a social difference, you know. So it's a movement, and all of these things are kind of emerging now, and so it looks like the fire is spreading. This one is a good one, and that is wonderful, and that is really one of the things that we wanted to do. The other one is to create a body of knowledge and information that can be retrieved at any moment. And we have that. We have over 50 hours of videotapes from lectures, conversations, interviews, and all these are being transcribed, and some of them hopefully become a book at some point. And so we are going to have a legacy of this work that we have done, which is very gratifying to me, you know, and not just for having done this, having had the privilege of having the opportunity to invent, create this thing. But also, I have met wonderful people along the way, and these are friends and colleagues that I'm going to, I'll be close to for a very long time. So from that perspective, this is all wonderful. And then, of course, my work individually will continue as I write more and more books and give talks, where I do bring this confluence of knowledge to the fore, both, you know, bringing science, philosophy, history, and religion into the conversation of the nature of human knowledge. And in particularly right now, on the need that we have to embrace a more global humanistic approach to who we are, informed by science, so that we can actually flourish in the next few decades as opposed to self-destruct. So that is the big goal, it's a big mission, but it's something that I feel very privileged to be part of.
And it's a very important mission, and I'm so excited to see where that will take us. Thank you very much, Marcel. It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure, Franklin. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. I'm grateful to ICE at Dartmouth, Marcelo Gleiser, and Amy Flockton for helping make this episode possible. We listen to The Wonder of Science by Alexa Music. Stay tuned for more episodes.